So yeah, as Alain said, I'm going to talk today about work that goes in our lab and specifically involving homeoprotein signaling through perineural emits. So we study homeoproteins, which are transcription factors that have well-known roles in development for body plan and organ regionalization. And they contain a highly conserved homeodomain, which has a three-helix bundle that binds DNA. But Alain and colleagues several decades ago found that this conserved homeodomain also contains sequences that allowed homeoproteins, homeodomains, to be secreted from a cell and target a neighboring cell. And so these sequences allow for non-conventional secretion and internalization. And because it's non-conventional, this internalization allows direct access to the cytoplasm and the nucleus. So homeoproteins can signal to neighboring cells and also have direct activity within the nucleus or the cytoplasm. They can bind RNA and DNA, so therefore have functions in regulating translation and transcription in neighboring cells. And so this was first shown in vitro, and in the last decade we've been trying to look for in vivo evidence for homeoprotein signaling. And in fact, this is the case. So several labs, not just ours, have shown that homeoprotein signal in eukaryotes from plants to flies and also invertebrates from fish, frogs, and mice. And my work has been mainly focused on mice, specifically for critical period plasticity. So the plasticity I'm referring to here is what others have already mentioned, but it's really plasticity of connectivity. So for example, here, this is showing the critical period for ocular dominance plasticity. So mice are born in about two weeks after their eyes open, their sensory input, and there's a period of plasticity that opens about 3 weeks postnatal. And during this period, in the binocular region of the cortex, so there's a region that receives input from the ipsilateral eye and the contralateral eye, most of the connectivity in the primary visual cortex is monocular, it receives contralateral inputs, but there is this small region here. And during this binocular critical period, there can be remodeling of the connections corresponding to ipsilateral and contralateral eye. And so if you temporarily shut the contralateral eye during this period, you can get an increase in connectivity from the ipsilateral eye. So if you close the eye, before or after, you don't get this massive remodeling. And so this results in a change in response. So if you do monocular deprivation in the juvenile, you get change in response from contralateral ipsilateral. You do that in the adult, you do not change response. And changes in response affect visual acuity in the mouse. And so what is driving these critical periods is the maturation of parvalbumin cells. And so their expression increases here 2 weeks to 5 weeks postnatal. And it affects the balance of excitation and inhibition in the cortex. And so to open the critical period, you need a fine balance between excitation and inhibition. And then this is consolidated to a non-plastic state in the adult. And so many labs have been working on this, and there's lots of cellular and molecular mechanisms that are coming to light. Growth factors and parvalbumin excitation inhibition balance. But you can see that, in fact, all along this process, you've got extracellular matrix changes. So at the beginning, you've got a decrease in PSA and CAM expression. During the critical period, you've got TPA proteases that are enhancing synaptic plasticity. And then to consolidate, to turn off critical periods, as everyone's mentioned before, you've got the increased expression of perineural nets. And in fact, so these molecules that turn off plasticity have given hope as they could be breaks that can be removed and regain plasticity. So Tommaso has shown in rats that when you remove perineural nets, you can regain plasticity in the adult. So opening therapeutic perspectives to plasticity experiments. And so our lab, in strong collaboration with that of Takao, has shown that homeoproteins specifically the OTX2 homeoprotein regulates cerebral cortex plasticity. So it can be involved in the timing and the development of the critical period, and also it's implicated in adult plasticity or adult break of plasticity. So I'll just summarize the data that we obtained to show this. So here by immunohistochemistry, you see that at 3 weeks postnatal, so this is just before the opening of the critical period, we have very low OTX2 expression and parvalbumin expression. And then at the peak of the critical period, at about 3 weeks, we see strong expression of both markers, and these are co-localized. I should mention, we didn't put a lot of emphasis on this, but so we've got about 80% of OTX2 is in PV cells, and the other 20% is in calretinin cells. So 100% is going into parvalbumin neurons. Into GABAergic interneurons. What's also interesting is that the expression of OTX2, the accumulation of OTX2 in the cortex, depends on activity. So if you remove both eyes, no OTX2 accumulates in the cortex. And if you raise the mouse in a dark environment, you do not see OTX2 accumulation. And so several gain-of-function experiments were performed involving the infusion of OTX2 protein in the cortex. And so in the dark reared model, when you infuse OTX2, you get increased expression of parvalbumin and also perinolar nets, labeled here by the WFA lectin. And what was rather striking about these experiments, which I'll come back to later though, is that OTX2 didn't just go into any cell, which we had seen in vitro. When you added homeoproteins to cells in culture, they go into neurons, to hex cells, they don't differentiate. Here in the cortical, in the cortex, we see OTX2 accumulating specifically in parvalbumin cells. Another homeoprotein in grailed went into layer 6 cells and did not accumulate into parvalbumin cells. So these experiments and other knockdown experiments led us to propose a two-threshold model for regulation of OTX2 in critical periods. So when we infused OTX2, we accelerated both the opening and closing of critical periods. When we reduced OTX2 amounts in the visual cortex, we actually delayed the opening of the critical period. So this leads to a two-threshold model where a first concentration threshold, so by increasing, accelerating the amount of OTX2, we open and close faster, and by delaying, we delay the opening and also the closure of the critical period. And in fact, this OTX2 is non-cell autonomous. So when we looked at the locus for OTX2, it is completely silent in the visual cortex, and is in fact strongly expressed in the choroid plexus, also in the supraculiculus and the thalamus, and also in the retina. The model that Hiroshi showed, having the OTX2 coming through the synapse, going into parvalbumin cells, was based on our work on the retina, where we show that OTX2 coming from the retina could get into parvalbumin cells. But here, we've got OTX2 coming from the plexus, being secreted into the cerebral spinal fluid, shown here by Western blot, and getting into parvalbumin cells. So here is the visual cortex, but it's also getting into other cells within the parenchyma. Here, shown here, auditory and amygdala. And so, and in each of these regions, we do see parvalbumin cell specificity, which we see in the visual cortex. And so we speculated that while homeoproteins interact with DNA, they interact with sugars, and it led us to hypothesize that maybe they're interacting with the perineural nets around parvalbumin cells. And so we identified a glycosaminoglycan binding sequence within OTX2 homeoprotein. And indeed, OTX2 accumulates in 80 or 90% WFA cells. I didn't show the graph here, but it's quite striking. And so this led us to design the RK peptide, which James talked about this morning. And so this contains the glycosaminoglycan sequence. And when we infuse this into the brain of an adult mouse, or the visual cortex of an adult mouse, we see decreased accumulation of endogenous OTX2 and concomitant decrease in PNN assembly and parvalbumin expression. So the model would be here is that the RK peptide when infused, is binding to sugars within perinolinets and blocking access to the endogenous OTX2 protein. So here we have the AA peptide as a control. It does not change, and there was also scrambled peptide as a control. And so ocular dominance analysis bias showed that when you treat, so this is an experiment done in mouse, but mimics what Tomaso had done with rats. When you remove perinolinets in the adult, you can change the bias for connectivity towards the ipsilateral eye, showing adult plasticity. When we infuse the RK peptide, we were also able to induce adult plasticity, indicating that the entry of OTX2 is critical for maintaining a break on adult plasticity. So that's what we summarized here. And in fact, we were able to rescue amblyopic mouse by using this technique. And so this has led us to another offshoot of this is that we found that there's a strong feedback loop between OTX2 and PNN expression. So we've got OTX2 coming from the choroid plexus, being secreted in the cerebral spinal fluid, binding to the PNNs of parvalbumin cells and getting in. And so before the critical period, we need initial sensory input, which starts promoting the assembly of perineuronets and allows the accumulation, the specific accumulation of OTX2 from the cerebral spinal fluid. And during the critical period, we've got an increase in perineuronets due to OTX2 activity within the cell. And so OTX2 promotes PNNs, and PNNs promotes OTX2 accumulation. And until we reach a stable amount of PNN and OTX2 in the adult, and OTX2 needs to continue to accumulate to offset turnover within parvalbumin cells. And so what we see in the dark rearing, we have no sensory input. Therefore, PNNs don't start to accumulate, and we don't get OTX2 coming in from the CSF. And we can induce maturation by infusing OTX2 and therefore kickstarting this feedback loop. And then for adult plasticity, we've used various techniques. Well, there's the destruction of PNNs that then reduces the amount of OTX2. We also have the RK peptide that blocks entry of OTX2 into the cells. And we've also knocked down OTX2 in the choroid plexus itself, the expression, and that reduces PNN accumulation, OTX2 accumulation, PNN accumulation, and induces adult plasticity. However, all of these experiments, for example, the RK peptide, it mimics the gag binding sequence of OTX2, and there are other gag binding molecules that interact with PNN, such as SEMA3A, that have very similar gag binding sequences. So in fact, we cannot discount that some of that blocking is also other molecules that can interact with PNNs. And so we really need genetic models to show OTX2 activity. And so that's what we've been focusing our efforts on the last few years. However, so the caveat of having this fantastic protein that can transfer between cells is that these sequences, we cannot mutate them because they in fact will abrogate cell autonomous function, because this is in the DNA, highly conserved DNA binding domain. Any mutations that we make here, there's too many changes that go on. So because of that, we've turned to two different models, and I'll talk about these two models today. One is a single chain antibody mouse, and the other is the OTX2 AA mouse, so a mouse that changed the gag binding sequence. So single chain antibodies are derived from a monoclonal antibody. They're subcloned and linked. And so this creates a mini gene that then, when fused with a signal peptide, when expressed in the cell, will be secreted, therefore not affecting cell autonomous function of the homing protein, and in fact trap it in the extracellular matrix. So we made a mouse, a stop-lox mouse, that has a single chain antibody fused to a single peptide. So this allows for Cre-induced expression of a secreted homeoprotein, single chain antibody for homeoprotein. So when we crossed these mice, the single chain OTX2 mice, with mice that express Cre under the Pre-V promoter, We found, so this is not an inducible promoter. It will start expressing Cre at about 2 weeks postnatal. So that means around PV cells where at least single chain antibodies for OTX2 begin to express and to accumulate. And what we see is that OTX2, endogenous OTX2 levels are indeed decreased when crossed with the single chain antibody for OTX2. Here our control are single chain antibody mice for PAX6, another homeoprotein that is not expressed in the choroid plexus or in PV cells. And so to evaluate plasticity in this paradigm, what we did is we dissected layer 4 of the visual cortex and did qPCR analysis for plasticity genes. And compared to wild type or the control mouse, we see that there is a delay, there is less expression of plasticity genes, indicating that there's a delay in the opening of a critical period in these mice at P30 when wild type mice are normally highly plastic. The second approach we use with these mice is to express the single chain antibody in choroid plexus of adult mice. And so we have a technique whereby infusing Cre recombinase fused to an internalization peptide, here TAT, when infused into the ventricle of the adult brain, it accumulates specifically in the choroid plexus. And so by doing this, we were able to target expression of a single chain antibody, either PAX6 or OTX2, in the choroid plexus. And then these are extracts of cerebral spinal fluid because it's secreted into the cerebral spinal fluid. So the idea here is that the single chain antibody is sequestering OTX2 that is found in the cerebral spinal fluid. And so we 2 weeks after injection of Cre-TAT, we see, again, reduction of endogenous levels of OTX2, reduced parvalbumin expression, and WFA, PNN assembly, in the adult cortex. And concomitantly, we see massive increase in expression of plasticity genes analyzed by qPCR. And we also did functional analysis on these mice. And so here we looked at ocular dominance plasticity by using optical imaging, which measures heme dynamics within the visual cortex. And so here we have three-month-old mice. We inject them with Cre-TAT, wait for 2 weeks, and then close the lateral contralateral eye for 4 days, and then perform optical imaging. And what we see is that there's an increase in visual acuity of the ipsilateral eye with no change in the contralateral eye, resulting in a shift in ocular dominance for the ipsilateral eye. And so our ongoing work with these mice is to identify targets now for OTX2 and parvalbumin cell maturation. And we've just designed the viruses now, which will allow us to do a lot more local expression of single chain antibodies and also local Cre-inducible expression of single chain antibodies. And we've also used this single chain technique to make a single chain antibody against chondroitin sulfate E based on the monoclonal antibody from Linda Say Wilson. And so we'd like to use this antibody to also investigate OTX2 PNN and interactions within the mouse. So the second model that we've worked on the last few years is that of the OTX2 AA mouse. So this is a knock-in of this RK doublet change to alanine. And we then analyzed the accumulation of OTX2, endogenous OTX2, in the visual cortex. And what we see is that there are increased amounts of cells now labeled with OTX2. So this is, indeed we see an increased number of cells, and these cells do not contain WFA. So in fact, the mutating the GAG binding sequence is changing the specificity for parvalbumin cells. So and these are heterozygous mice. So half is wild type protein. It's getting into PV cells. And the other half contains GAG binding, a compromised GAG binding sequence. And so some of that protein is not going into PV cells, but into other cells. And in fact, those other cells happen to be calretinin cells, but they do not change the expression of calretinin. And so when we look at the accumulation of OTX2 within PV cells, since the same amount of protein is being secreted from the choroid plexus, or is in the cerebral spinal fluid, Some of the protein is going into other cells, so you'd expect less protein getting into parvalbumin cells, and that's what we see here. We see the wild type at around P60 is saturates, whereas in our OTX2AA mice, it doesn't saturate until after postnatal day 100. And in these mice, we see delayed assembly of perineuronal nets and delayed expression in parvalbumin. So this would suggest that these mice have delayed critical periods, and that is indeed what we see. So this is ocular dominance analysis done by visual, by VEP recordings to determine visual acuity. So this is wild-type mice. When you do monocular deprivation at P30, you get a decrease in visual acuity, but not at P100, not at P200. For the OTX2AA mice, however, they are not plastic at P30. They are plastic at P100 and not at P200. So these mice have a clear shift in their critical period timing for ocular dominance plasticity. But as I mentioned before, OTX2 from the plexus is gaining access, has wide access to the parenchyma. We saw it in somatosensory cortex, auditory, and other higher order cortices. And as you know, critical periods are not restricted to visual cortex. They occur throughout the brain with specific timing and sequence, and they generally start from primary sensory areas and move up to higher brain areas for behavior and cognition. And so we looked at another primary cortex, the auditory cortex, and a higher order cortex, the limbic cortex. And so these are the critical period, normal critical period times for wild type in these structures. And indeed, with the OTX2AA mice, we find OTX2 to be mislocalized also in these two regions. We see increased number of OTX2 positive cells in both regions, and within PV cells, a decreased accumulation of parvalbumin and of OTX2, and decreased expression of parvalbumin and decreased PNN assembly. And so critical period plasticity analysis was done on these mice. These mice were found to have a delayed critical period for tonotopic plasticity, and which I'll show here, they had a change in their preference for acoustic preference. And so this test, this was done in the lab of Taka Lynch. The acoustic, so mice, when they nest, they prefer silence, which is normal. About three quarters of mice prefer to nest in a silent environment and not in an environment where music is played 3 hours a day. If you, these mice are exposed to music during the critical period, however, they will change their nesting behavior. And then when they're adults, will nest in the musical environment. If you expose them in music, however, when they're adults, they do not change their preference. And so the test is, the behavioral task is here. Over a period of 2 weeks, adult mice are exposed, placed in an open field with two nesting areas, and they're exposed to one area has silent, and the other area plays music for 3 hours. And so you look at the behavior of the mouse at the start and at the end of this 3 hour period, and you see what their nesting preferences are. And so when we look at the distribution of nesting behavior after 2 weeks, we see that the OTX2AA mice, they heavily increase their preference for music, whereas wild-type mice do not like music. There you go. And if you're wondering, the music was Beethoven. I forget which symphony, but Taco could tell you, I guess. First. And there was also, because it's an open field, it allowed Taco to look at anxiety behavior, and in fact we saw that the mice cross the center more after the 2 week period compared to wild type. They travel more and they stay in the center more. So yeah, they cross more and they stay in the center more. So these mice are showing reduced anxiety, reduced fear. And in our lab, we also did an elevated plus maze. So this is following exactly the same lines as what Hiroshi showed for his knockout mice. We used to do knockout mice. Wild-type mice prefer to be in the closed arms. Whereas the eight OTX2A mice spend more time out in the open arms, suggesting reduced anxiety for these mice. There was also, we also looked at changes in, so we see a decrease in parvo PNN accumulation, and we wondered whether there was also change in PNN molecules. And so this is, these are FACS cells, qPCR FACS cells, and comparing wild type and OTX2AA mice in visual cortex at P100. So when wild type mice are not plastic, but the OTX2AA mice are, or in medial prefrontal cortex of P60 mice, so when wild-type mice are not plastic, but the OTX2AA mice are, we see that there is ongoing dynamic expression of certain PNN molecules. So not exactly the same in the two areas, suggesting regional differences in these PNNs. Nonetheless, it's clear that OTX2 activity might be influencing PNN structure and therefore the binding of other molecules to the PNNs. So in conclusion, we can indeed state that OTX2 is a general regulator of cortical plasticity. There's an activity-dependent opening of critical periods, and that OTX2 recognition of cortical DAGs, specific recognition, is important for and necessary for the opening and the proper timing of critical periods, and that just small reductions in the amount of OTX2 getting into PV cells, small reduction activity, is sufficient to delay plasticity windows. And reduced OTX2 activity alters PNN assembly, and therefore providing a feedback loop between OTX2 and PNNs. It's fine, I'm done. You can Many thanks. I'd like to thank Clémence Bernard, who was instrumental in both studies, Clémentine Vincent, who helped with the single chain antibody study, as well as Damien Testa and Jérôme Ribot, who performed the optical imaging analysis. Really strong thanks to Taco Hench and his team, specifically Henry Lee, postdoc who was implicated in the single the OTX2AA mice, looking at visual cortex plasticity, and Jean-Lé Lee, who did the acoustic preference analysis and tonotopic map study, and Antonio Simeoni, who provided the OTX2AA mice and our funding sources. Thank you very much.